Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to As It Is, the program that helps you learn and improve your American English and find out what is happening around the world at the same time. Today, we talk about things happening here in the United States. First, one of America's best-known religious organizations is considering a plan to punish Israel for its actions in the occupied territories. We will hear from both sides in the debate. Then we're off to sunny California, where lately it has been too sunny and too hot. We'll meet some special firefighters who are preparing for the worst. As It is coming to you from VOA, Washington. One of America's oldest Christian groups is holding leadership meetings this week. The Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA is taking place in Detroit, Michigan. One proposal under consideration is a plan to end investments with companies that do business with Israel. Delegates are set to vote on the measure this Friday. If approved, the Presbyterian Church would be the largest religious organization in the U.S. to approve sanctions against Israel. Beverly Dempsey is the acting head of the Western Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. She offers prayers for the Presbyterian leaders meeting in Detroit.
As the General Assembly moves into full swing, there are many issues that do threaten to tear the PCUSA apart.
Like other traditional Protestant groups, the Presbyterian Church USA has been losing members. The church has fewer than 2 million members. Same-sex marriage and other issues have often divided churchgoers. One of those other issues is a proposal to cancel investments in American companies whose products are used by Israel in the occupied territories. If the plan is approved, it would be a major victory for the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement. The movement wants sanctions to punish Israel, similar to those used against South Africa during its white minority rule. Susan Wilder is with the Presbyterian Israel Palestine Mission Network. She says the proposal is not aimed at reducing or destroying the rights of Israel.
But we do need to shine a spotlight on Israel's on bad policies. You know, this isn't about good guys and bad guys or being against Israel or being wanting to isolate into Israel or even punish Israel. This is about wanting to shine a spotlight on actions that are harming everyone.
John Wimberly is a retired clergyman. He formerly served at the Western Presbyterian Church.
There's a 2,000-year history of economic sanctions being used by Christians aimed at Jews. And it's a bloody and it's a nasty history. And that's kind of my bottom line opposition is right there.
John Wimberly says the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement ignores Palestinian attacks on Israel. And he thinks the movement has been pushed by activists from outside the church.
This divestment thing has come up ever since 2004 at every General Assembly. And at every General Assembly, the Presbyterian Church, which is kind of a progressive body, has defeated it. So Israel has lots of friends in the mainline churches.
But supporters of Israel fear a vote in support of the proposal could lead to similar action by other religious groups. That would leave Israel with fewer friends among more liberal Protestant Christians. Years of dry weather have put the state of California at risk of a serious fire season. In Southern California, firefighters are training to be ready for the next big wildfire. So let's head west and hear what Ana Mateo has to say about what could be a dangerous situation.
Record high temperatures in May led to serious wildfires near the city of San Diego. The wildfires appeared months before California's fire season usually begins. This followed nearly 3 years of little rainfall and the driest year on record last year. It left trees and other plant life extremely dry. Richard Cordova works for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, known as Cal Fire.
When we have higher temperatures, lower humidity, and you throw winds in there, it's just a recipe for extreme fire danger. And when we see those, all those three elements come together, Cal Fire reacts and starts moving equipment around.
In the town of Hemet, California, a Cal Fire Air Tactical Unit trains to stay prepared. The training takes place at an airbase for firefighting crews. Helicopters take the crews to wildfires, and tankers drop flame-retardant chemicals from the air. The chemicals help to suppress the production of fire. Mike Venable is a pilot who flies an air tanker for Cal Fire. He has put out minor fires on nearby grasslands.
Everything from that to the challenging 12, 14,000 foot peaks, maybe up in the high Sierras or, you know, in the forests that surround our base here. So it's a very big variety of flying. Some can be very dangerous, some not so dangerous.
Pilots and firefighters keep their equipment ready. Daily meetings about weather conditions keep them informed about areas at risk of fire. Careful measurement of fuel load and the weather help with flight planning. Battalion Chief Travis Alexander says aircraft are deployed throughout the state and can reach a fire in minutes. He says the planes and helicopters are there to back up firefighting crews on the ground.
The aircraft in this agency is just one of many tools. We have the hand crews, the dozers, engine companies, a variety of other assets. The air program comes in as a support function.
At a nearby fire station, crews stay ready to fight fires in populated and rural areas. Pilot Max Venable says air and ground crews work to keep the fires away from homes and other buildings.
If you're able to help somebody on the ground, save a house, keep a firefighter out of a hazardous situation, that's rewarding.
It is a continuing effort to stay ahead of the fires. State officials say they have added 300 new firefighters. Thousands of others already work as firefighters in California. Their job this year is likely to be a hard one. I'm Anna Mateo.
We would like to remind you again to be sure and visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. If you do, you will find many more stories than we have time to put on the radio. To improve your American English, we urge you to read along with us as you hear the words to each story. You can print the stories and save them for later. You can also download all of our As It Is programs in audio form and save them on your computer. It's a great way to learn English, and best of all, it's free. And here is another thing to keep in mind. As It Is comes to you 7 days a week. Immediately after our program, there are two more Learning English shows. Each day there is something different. You can learn about health, science, economics, education, and even the history of the United States on our long-running program, The Making of a Nation. If you can stay with us that long, you will find that we are back at the beginning of another hour. That's when we provide a summary of world news from the VOA newsroom. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This is VOA, Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. The oil industry is growing fast in the American states of North Dakota and Montana. Removing oil from the ground has made a lot of money for the area and provided many jobs. The industry also has brought thousands of people to rural towns that once had small populations. Williston, North Dakota, is a good example. The United States Census Bureau says the Williston area was the fastest growing place of its size and description from July 1, 2011 to July 1, 2012. It said the population growth was 9.3%. Adding many people means increased demand for roads, emergency services, and other systems like electricity, heating, and water. And more children attending schools can mean crowding in the community's classrooms. John Monger was born and raised in Williston. He has taught at the city's Hagen Elementary School for 24 years. For the last 3 years, he has taught in a temporary structure called a trailer. The classrooms are smaller than usual. He started the year with 16 students. Now Mr. Monger has 18 in the small space. Viola LaFontaine is the leader of Williston Public Schools. That area of schools is the smallest in North Dakota, but it is also growing the fastest. She says the schools increased their population by more than 1,000 students during the past 4 to 5 years. The majority are elementary school children. In addition, she says, the students come from all over the world.
I believe it's 7 different languages that we have spoken in the school now. And the majority are Spanish, but we have Cantonese, we have French.
Ms. LaFontaine says it is difficult to deal with the continuing changes in student population.
The greatest challenge is the students coming in and out and throughout the whole entire school year, which is something different, as well as students leaving throughout the entire school year.
The official says it is also hard to hire qualified teachers and to pay for larger and more modern schools. She notes that the state is receiving a lot of money from oil. She has asked the North Dakota government for education assistance.
I mean, North Dakota's always been conservative. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but now that you've got ample resources, let us have some of it. Whether it's grants or loans or, you know, preferably grants that you could use to really support your schools.
Voters in Williston District 1 recently approved a measure to build a new high school. The measure will increase property taxes. But education activists say Williston taxes are less than those in similar North Dakota communities. And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. You can listen to our reports at our website or download them. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. I'm Jerry Watson.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. War with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party. And Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their Northern and Southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular Democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that four new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that three of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only one railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists, and it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages. The bitter dispute over Nebraska will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.